Hi, I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich, and this is the Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 16th, 2013. This show is not only about how to get more money out of all the decisions that you make, but more value. This week in How We Live Money, there seems to be some solid bright spots in the housing market, and in many areas of the U.S., home values are continuing to rise. But so are interest rates. Now, that has many folks asking, is now really the best time to buy a home?
So my question is, can I continue to do this?
I was wondering what your thoughts would be about.
Would it be better to set it to...
I've been wondering whether it's really worth it.
So Jennifer is wondering if it's time for her to buy, and she's out in Portland, Oregon. She lives there with her husband, and they rent. They always have. Jennifer, let's start with the math, because you have an interesting way of how you want to finance buying the house.
We think we can afford the monthly payments, but getting that down payment is the biggest hurdle for us right now. And I have about $10,000 in my Roth IRA that is part of my retirement plan. And I'm wondering if it's a wise financial decision to take that money out of the Roth IRA to use towards the down payment of a house.
Let's talk about why you want to buy right now. What are you feeling, and why do you feel like now is the time to do it?
We know that we both really want to stay in Portland for the long term. My family's here. We intentionally moved back to Portland. Given how high the rents are, it seemed like maybe rather than paying somebody else's personal investment in their home, you know, that they're renting out, that we should be building our own equity.
And you mentioned that, you know, that you guys want to stay put. This seems like a good time. And you mentioned the equity and that being an investment. And that's one of those things that we talk about a lot in personal finance as to the value of a home as an investment. Have you seen prices where you are go up substantially?
The prices have been astronomical in the Portland area over the last few years. It seems like from what I've read, this interest rates are still really good right now, although they might be climbing a little bit.
And what about your savings? Do you have, I mean, you mentioned the Roth. Do you guys have any other cash savings and retirement savings?
We both have retirement savings because we've been working in the public sector for several years. I have about $5,000 in savings, and my husband doesn't have any. We do have a car that we can sell that's worth about $10,000. We don't drive that much here, so it would actually work out really well.
So if you have that five in cash, you have the car that you could sell, is the Roth, the $10,000 in Roth, is that in addition to those two things for a down payment?
Yes, it would be.
And the reason why I'm asking is because you mentioned low interest rates. The thing with low interest rates in terms of mortgages is those interest rates that you see in the news all the time are really only for the absolute best buyers. I'll ask you, how's your credit?
When we got a car loan a couple of years ago, it was no problem, and the bank told us that we had a really good credit.
Good. Well, that's good. That's on your side. But one thing that's not necessarily on your side is that banks now, unlike the past, actually, they really care about how much cash you have after the down payment. In order to get the best rate, you really would have to make sure that you have some cash. A lot of lenders want to see 6 months worth of mortgage payments in the bank after the down payment. Is that possible?
Maybe in a year. It's not possible right now.
I absolutely understand the pressure for wanting to buy, especially in a pricey market. If you're renting, you feel like you're being left behind a bit and you want to make sure to lock it in now because it's only going up. But I want you guys to be able to keep a house. I love for people to be able to buy it right and be able to keep it. And one of the ways to be able to keep your home is to make sure that you have cash savings, even after the down payment. Now, one other thing, your mortgage and owning a home, that mortgage price, that monthly payment, is only a fraction of the true cost of owning a home. So the other real costs are maintenance, property taxes, and home insurance can be more. Now, you'll have a mortgage deduction, but just know that your costs will actually go up. Do you guys feel like you need to do it now for any other reason? Could you wait?
We could wait. The pressure we're feeling is this fear that, you know, rates are going to go up, that the housing prices are going to start to rise again.
The fact of the matter is that the mortgage rate that you get today with no savings, and if you have to pay points, could be the same cost as a year from now, if mortgage rates go up. And one thing to keep in mind is that historically, any mortgage rate at or below 6% is an absolute bargain. Guess how much we were paying for mortgage interest rates back in the 80s.
I don't have a clue.
17-18%.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, 6% sounded pretty good.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you look historically. It gives you a little bit more perspective because what you're hearing now around you is buzz about interest rates going up. So it builds a lot of this pressure. Is there any other pressure that you guys are having in terms of buying? Is it truly just this real estate interest rate pressure? Is there anything else?
There is a little social pressure when all of your friends own houses, but they're not necessarily putting pressure on ourselves. I think it's just a sort of a general push in this country is home ownership. There's a mindset that we have to really process through. I mean, ask ourselves, why do we want to buy? Because it does seem like there's this social pressure everywhere that that's how, you know, the idea of the American dream, that sort of thing.
You just named it. It's that idea of the American dream. But actually pushing home ownership before the recession was a big reason why so many bad mortgages were able to be had and available and then signed. But what's really important is the American dream of security and stability. So to have that and to be able to keep that home, to buy it in the right way. Okay, here's a little checklist, Jennifer. I'll give you a little checklist right now. Go online, look at the property taxes on these homes that you're looking at. Call your insurer if you have renter's insurance and see what a home policy would cost. Get an idea maybe of some maintenance costs and say, well, what would happen if this breaks or that breaks? Let's budget, you know, a couple $1,000s throughout the whole year. And if you look at that and you break it up monthly and add it to the mortgage, how much more would that be than the rent? So it is going to be more expensive, but to have a real goal in mind as to the reality of home ownership, then make sure that you go and set up a plan to save more money. Do you and your husband have wiggle room in terms of saving every month more cash?
Yeah, we could stow away a few $100s every month.
That's great. A few $100 is excellent. If you can do that and get an idea as to, okay, so how much would the down payment actually be? What would we need to have on hand to cover our housing expenses and living expenses for 6 months? And then what would it be like to take on a mortgage plus property taxes, plus home insurance, plus maintenance versus where you're at today? Now, if you're saving a couple hundred extra bucks a month, that means that you probably could afford the additional costs of home ownership. But what would be great is if you also had that cash on hand so that when you buy the home, you get the best interest rate and you will be able to be secure that should anything happen in terms of your income, you'll be at least in the green safe zone for a little while.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your help.
And you can find those tips I mentioned at marketplacemoney.org and input from your fellow listeners on our Facebook page. And if you have a housing question, tweet at LiveMoney. When natural disasters hit, just like the typhoon that struck the Philippines earlier this week, the first thing that many of us want to do is help. But there are a lot of shady characters out there who are looking to take advantage of our generosity, and there are some charities that just don't make good use of our donations. So how do you know where it's best to put your money? CharityNavigator.org features a rating system of 1 to 4 stars of dozens of charities, and it gives some insight to not only where it's best to give, but how well these charities use the money that you do give. Sandra Minuti is the Vice President of Charity Navigator. Hi, Sandra.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. You know, I know you're very busy at this time. What gives a charity a 4-star rating? What do they need to do?
When a charity has received our highest rating, it excels in its financial health, meaning most of its money is going into its charitable programs and not spent on fundraising and administrative costs. It's bringing in more money each year, reinvesting that money in its programs. It'll complete an audit each year. It promises to donors it won't sell their information to other charities, which is how you wind up on all those lists and with a mailbox full of appeals. Because most donors, face it, we don't have time to do this day to day. And especially when a disaster occurs, you want to find quickly who you can support and really put your money behind.
And we should note as well that you guys are a nonprofit. What are the best ways to give, and should we be careful about how we give, texting versus on the phone versus a check? How should we do it right?
I think the best way to give is give directly to a charity. I would never give over the phone. Usually when you receive those telephone calls, it's a telemarketing firm and they're going to keep 80, 90, 95% of your contribution. So I encourage donors to just hang up on those calls. Look for the charity's legitimate website and give directly there. Texting can be fine, especially after disasters when we want to give immediately. But usually that money does take some time to get to the charity. Be wary of social media. Be careful in clicking through on Twitter or Facebook. I think they are powerful tools to inspire us to want to give. They can show us heart-wrenching photos and tell personal stories. But you never want to click through on those appeals because you don't know who's behind them.
Now, I have a question for you in terms of the disaster itself. We have, you know, Sandy and Haiti and now the Philippines. What particularly is different when it comes to giving with international disasters or this one in particular versus others?
I think the thing to keep in mind with a disaster on this scale is to look for charities that have done this type of work before, either working in the region or they've provided this specific type of relief before. You don't want to go with a brand new charity that has just popped up that doesn't even have stationery. It's going to be very difficult for them to be effective. And I think, yeah, each disaster is very different. This one definitely has pulled at the heartstrings of Americans, and we've seen a big uptick in interest on our site and visits to our site, and many charities telling us about how they're participating in the relief efforts, and they're telling us they're getting a lot of inquiries and a lot of donations rolling in.
Sandra Minuti is the Vice President of Charity Navigator. Thank you so much, Sandra, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Looking for more information on the smartest ways to give? Go to marketplacemoney.org. Coming up, well, at least it's not under his mattress.
Currently, I am 28 and have about $500,000 sitting in a checking account and know I should be doing something with that money.
Don't let that number of zeros fool you. Advice for investments, big and small. That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich.
I have a question.
My question is,
you know, whether it's giving to charity, as we just discussed, or getting out from loads of debt, it's not easy to know what's the best thing to do with your money. So we're here to help. Doug Flynn joins us. He's a certified financial planner and co-founder of Flynn Zito Capital Management. Great to have you, Doug.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to head out to Justin. He's just outside of Akron, Ohio. Justin, welcome. What's your question for us?
My question is, how do I begin investing? Currently, I am 28 and have about $500,000 sitting in a checking account.
Justin.
And know I should be doing something with that money, but really haven't got around to do anything with it yet.
You wild and crazy guy, $500,000 man. What's your home situation like?
I currently own a house, about $400,000 house, and have about $100,000 in equity in it.
Okay, and you have children?
I have one daughter who is 10.
Okay, Justin, you find yourself in a very interesting position of having all that money, and now it's what to do with it. Doug, that's a tremendous amount of cash.
It is. And if with a 10-year-old daughter, I think that one of the first things you probably want to do is make sure that she's set up for college. So I'm wondering.
Really? Really?
Well, I think that, you know, I wonder, have you looked into 529s at all yet?
Yeah, I have, and I definitely think that's one place that I feel comfortable putting money, and I do need to get that set up for sure.
But what about retirement and cash savings? How much should he have? Somebody like Justin, mm-hmm. how much should he have in emergency savings, for example?
Well, what kind of what's your savings ability? Are you ever at the end of each month? Are you putting money away? How do you look?
Yeah, in the last 3 or 4 years, I've been saving probably about $100,000 to $150,000 a year.
Oh, wow! Goodness.
So
that's amazing.
As long as that's still the case, then what that does is that means that you don't necessarily need as much as other people might need for a cash cushion. So you probably can be on the short side. You know, 3 months worth of expenses
sure.
is really all you need, because in a couple of months you're going to have too much cash yet again. So it's really, the way I look at it is you have to sort of break this down into two things. There's planning strategies, and then there's the investment solution. So you want to talk about education as a planning strategy. You want to talk about retirement, and then decide, hey, how aggressive or conservative do I want to be with each of those? So they can be separate decisions. With that kind of savings ability, you don't need to be as aggressive as other people might need to be.
Well, Justin, I have to ask you because, you know, are you a business owner, or is this income that you can pretty much count on? Because if you are a business owner, there is some risk involved there
mm-hmm.
in terms of being able to lean on that income.
Yeah, definitely. And I am a business owner, so, you know, I do like having a little bit of extra money in the bank, just because you don't know if you have a bad year or, you know, anything can happen. So
that's a great point.
Yeah. So Doug, in that case, when you are a small business owner, and I am as well, I like to have more cash than most people.
Makes sense. If you have volatility of income and risk there, then you maybe take less risk somewhere else. But as a business owner, that just gets me really excited, because there's so many things that a business owner can take advantage of with retirement. You're able to put away so much money with retirement programs that are built around you as the business owner, more so than the average person who works for somebody else.
Justin, my question to you is, you know, do you have any other big goals besides retirement and college? For example, you have that home. Do you see yourself starting a new business or moving to a new home?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I like having some money on hand if I want to start other companies. So I like things to be kind of liquid. And I think that's what scares me about investing in retirement, is that, you know, as a typical young person probably feels, I feel like I will be dead by the time I'm 60 years old. You know, I will never see any of this money I've made. You know, and so, you know, we have plans to move to the beach and buy a beach house and different things. And I'm just worried that all my money will be in some retirement account that I may never see.
Ah, because you won't be able to realize it, because if you take the money out early, then you're going to get penalized. So, Doug, in that case, so if he's got $500,000, okay, which is all dream money to many folks listening right now, how do you break that up? And even if you take off a zero there, you know, and it's $50,000,
sure.
How would someone like Justin, who basically needs to keep cash on hand for two things? One, emergency, just in case the business doesn't do well.
That's right.
Two, because he wants to do something big with the money in the next 5 to 10 years.
Sure.
And then also save for those locking in cash into retirement, like a SEP and the 529.
Right.
How would you advise him to break this all up?
Well, it depends on how important. Well, you first have to identify how much are we talking about that you need to put away for these sort of short-term or intermediate-term goals. But once that's satisfied, you know, there's a lot of power in saying, how much will it take to fully fund my child's education? Put that to the side. It's done.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things that happen when you check that off in your brain. You know you're going to be able to fund her education. But when you physically do it, by putting it aside, you've checked it off. It's just like you have enough money to pay off the mortgage on your house.
No.
No, I'm not saying you should.
I know.
Yeah,
I'm
that's
saying
another question. I've had a financial planner that they write a check for it. And
well,
I know,
so,
you know, I know you guys would like cringe at that and say you have to invest your money.
Yes. Thank you for reading my mind,
yes.
Because, you know, Doug knows, like, I am so not a fan of that because, what is your interest rate on your mortgage right now?
It's kind of high, I guess, but it's about 5.25.
I still find
right
that
now,
but still
in his tax bracket, he's obviously in a high tax
bracket.
Right,
you're in a high tax bracket. I mean, it's a deduction. It's not, to me, this is not a pressing need, especially you're telling us that you want to buy and move someplace else.
Right. But here's the thing to think about also is you have the house paid off. even though you haven't done the financial transaction. The money's sure. over here. You could pay it off. So now it's a financial strategy. Does it make sense to pay it off? You can. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the education. Same thing with retirement. And there's also a lot of power. You're not going to get these years back. You know, one of my favorite quotes from Mickey Mantle is, if I knew how long I was going to live, I would have taken better care of myself.
Well, right.
And the point is that, you know, you might be gone tomorrow, but you might live to your 110.
Yeah.
So how do you plan both ends of it? And there's a lot of power in putting a little bit away for the future and sort of getting the feel for that. As you see the compounding and the power of that and the tax savings, you're definitely a person who's going to be able to do everything they want to do. It's just a matter of getting your hands around it and really developing, okay, this much for the intermediate term goals. I could put a little away for the longer term. Let me lock my daughter's education up. I've got these other businesses. I've got plenty of cash. And you know what? Even if you allocated everything, 1 year from now, you've got another $150,000 in cash.
Right.
So it's not like that's not going to be there.
Well, and Justin, one thing I admire about you, I mean, it sounds like you're making all this money and you haven't like gone and bought a McMansion. Like you're not somebody, you seem like you're a saver. I would be much more worried if you were not, if you were telling me, yeah, I earned this and I want to go, you know, buy a house in Bali and a timeshare and, you know, a McLaren or something. So you seem that you live not only within your means, but so well below your means that frankly, Doug, mm-hmm. that is a strategy
it
in
is.
And of itself, a tremendous That's, strategy.
One good thing about living in Akron, Ohio, it is very cheap.
Yeah, so don't come to New
bedroom,
York, okay?
Five-bedroom, 5,000-square-foot house, you know, $400,000. So
wait. But how much are the real estate taxes? That's the one that kills
me. $6,000.
Wow. Justin, just don't move to New York, New Jersey, or
tri-state
area, because all that money will be gone. That's all I got to say. So do you think, Justin, you know, considering the other short-term goals you have, the need to have some cash on hand, you know, what do you feel like would be the first step that you want to take to doing something with this money?
Yeah, I guess I feel like I need to find a good financial planner, and that I've talked to different people, and I always feel like they all specialize in one thing, mm-hmm. and so they push you towards that real heavily. Whether it's, you know, I've had people tell me pay off all your debts immediately.
Mm.
I've had people that just say put all your money in this mutual fund that we support.
Oh, no.
You know,
oh,
and
no.
I've had people say buy tons of life insurance. You know, so I just feel like I'm always getting someone that only does one thing, and I don't know how to find someone I can trust.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Justin. Whenever I get a CFP on this show, they are well vetted and they're not pushing anything in particular.
That's right.
Because you make a good point, Justin. What you want to do when you're looking for financial help is not only look for someone, hopefully, who is fee-based mm-hmm. as opposed to commission-based, but somebody who's not going to have you do all of one thing. Mm-hmm. Right, Doug? Because I think that
That's
this
right.
is a very dangerous scenario when you have somebody who has a lot of money mm-hmm. and people just smell that cash.
That's right. Yeah, I think that what you look into is someone who's a fiduciary, and how you find a fiduciary and what a fiduciary is someone who has to absolutely by law work in your best interest. And so you can go on CFP.net. You can find a registered investment advisor. Those two types of investment professionals are fiduciaries, and those would be hired in a way that have to work in your best interest. And it's like anything else. You want to interview them and find someone that's a good fit, like a doctor or anything else, because it is going to be a relationship. And then I think you'll get to the right answers for you and have comfortable strategies that fit with your risk level and what your objectives are. That's the way you have to do it.
Okay. You said that site is CFP.net?
CFP.net and another one is FPANet.org. Those two sites in there. Make sure you cross-reference folks that you interview at SEC.gov mm-hmm. to check their background and see if they have any violations. And you just want to make sure that you have somebody that you have great chemistry with, someone who's not going to steer you in one direction and who's used to working with people like you. Because, Justin, as we now know, you have tons of potential.
Well, thanks.
Thanks.
I definitely appreciate your advice and pointing me in the right direction.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks so much for joining us. Doug, stay with me. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. We are back with Doug Flynn. He's a CFP and founder of Flynn Zito Capital Management in New York, and we're taking your calls. We've got Ben from Albuquerque, New Mexico, who's a fantastic segue from Justin, our other caller. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Doug. Hi, Carmen. Congratulations on the new gig.
Oh, why, thank you, Saul. Thank you so much. So what's your question for us, Ben?
So I've been a longtime Marketplace Money listener, and I've heard of this mythic fee-only financial planner for quite a while now. And I'm at the point where we actually have some savings that we can mess up by making the wrong decision in asset allocation or other errors like that. And I was wondering what your advice might be in terms of, especially from Doug's perspective as a financial planner, what kind of materials we should bring for a general financial health checkup, or, and also secondarily, if there are any questions that you wish people would ask in these situations.
Well, you know, Ben, we do have your mythical beast here, your fee-based planner. Right. So, Doug, this is a really good question, because when you start, this is, we talked about this being a very long relationship, and you want this to be a long relationship.
Sure.
So it's so important to ask the right questions. What should Ben be asking?
Right. So one of the things you're going to do is you're probably going to want to bring along or send ahead information like your tax return and your pay stubs. A lot of advisors will want you to do an income and expense worksheet to get an idea of what your savings ability is at the end of each month. And of course, all your statements. But what's often overlooked is things like your employee benefit statements. If you work for a big company, and any kind of pension calculations, those types of things are great to bring along. And then you can sort of meet or interview whoever it is that you might be looking at hiring to be your financial advisor. And one of the keys in that meeting is to walk away knowing exactly whether or not they're a fiduciary so that they can work in your best interest, and how they're compensated. It needs to be extremely clear to you whether they're compensated on a fee basis or some kind of offset or, you know, commission or whatever the story is. You just need to be very, very clear. And they will tell you that. And in that first meeting, that's one of the things you want to walk away with.
So, Ben, one thing is that, you know, you and your wife, you're an engineer, she's a pediatrician, so you have a really good, solid income. However, medical school costs a lot, so you're also dealing with six figures of debt. And you're dealing with it right now by kind of splitting. You put a certain amount per year into cash savings and a certain amount into that debt. Are you flexible if you get feedback like, oh, maybe you want to do this instead with that debt? Because that's a lot of money.
We do have the flexibility. At the moment, I've been following the general advice of having automatic transfers into various accounts in terms of building up a long-term savings account or saving up for the next car, things like that. And it would not be much of an issue to shift more of that towards the debt. So what I'm looking for is kind of like what Justin's question was in terms of a checkup and determining what kind of strategy would be best in terms of allocating the savings to paying back the debt or just building up these various savings goals that I have. And also what vehicles we should use to build those savings, whether any of them are long-term enough to go into equities instead of just a regular savings account.
Oh, goodness, yes. Well, I'm sure we would want him to do that because he has a big ability to save. Mm-hmm. But, Ben, you bring up a really good question here because, Doug, I mean, you must see a lot of folks, you know, the cost of education is so high.
Yes.
Especially in fields like, let's say, you know, you become a doctor, you become a lawyer. So you're loaded with huge debt loads. How do you both, when you start earning real money, manage the debt versus the savings? Because sometimes it seems between the interest rates that it's just a game that you're kind of trying to claw up a mud wall.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, in developing a plan, and the person you work with would clearly do this for you, it comes down to interest rates. Is this one big loan? Are there multiple loans? Are there different interest rates? Are they deductible, which are not? You want to have a strategy. And there's a easy way to just, when you lay everything out, say, here's what develops. These accounts maybe you should pay off more aggressively. These ones pay the lightest amount on, and then let's start putting money away towards your goal. I think that too many times people focus solely on paying off the debt so much so, even if it's lower rate and deductible, that they never get going.
Right.
And 5 or 10 years go by and you lose that opportunity of the volatility of the market. So sometimes if the rates are not egregious, you mix that up. You say, listen, let's do this, and this is our plan. Maybe it's a little longer to pay it off, but we begin savings. Because what happens is when you start saving and investing and you're compounding and you see the growth of that, it becomes positively addicting. It's nice to pay off debt and satisfy
we
that.
We like positive addictions.
We do. There's so many negative ones. So, and what happens is as you start seeing it and it's building, you want to do more. Exactly.
It's feedback. So you're getting that
feedback. I like doing something on the savings side.
And I agree with you. I think, Ben, you know, a lot of that that debt, the medical school debt, is really, and it was an investment, right, in mm-hmm. her. So you never just want to look at that interest rate. So I think you guys are tackling that very well.
And Ben, it comes down to the goals, too. What are your specific goals? And minding the time frames. If there's one that's 3 years away or 10 years away, you'll invest accordingly.
Yeah, that sounds good. And actually, the only other thing, I mean, I to be more specific, the debt is around 2 times her income, but even as a pediatrician, which is on the very low end of the pay scale, as long as it's all federal debt, we found a tremendous amount of flexibility in paying it off, and you can definitely live a comfortable life. If not, you're not joining any yacht clubs, but you'll be comfortable. And
yeah, exactly. Well, you know, if you really want to be rich, you just got to want less.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
It's all in your head. Ben, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Doug, Carmen.
Doug, thank you so much for joining us today. Doug Flynn is a certified financial planner and founder of Flynn Zito Capital Management here in New York. Thank you, Doug.
Thanks, Carmen.
Have a money question? Head to AskCarmen at MarketplaceMoney.org or tweet at LiveMoney. Food and finances.
When we went to a restaurant, it was either a Chinese restaurant where the food was excellent and didn't cost much, or if it was American restaurant, it was $1.99 buffet. You know, take all you want, but you better finish it. You know, I had a sense that you had to value money.
And, you know, that ticket price? Well, it's just the starting point. A guide to getting the best travel deal. That's all on Marketplace Money from APM. You know, this happens year in and year out. November rolls around. My inbox gets filled with stories and studies, research, about family and the holidays. So each week we turn the mic over to hear a story about how those family moments, big and small, have shaped the way you live money. Today, one of my favorite writers, her tale.
My name is Amy Tan, and I'm a writer. In my house in Sausalito, in the living room, all of the artwork in there are illustrations, paintings, posters of women. There's nothing else. There are no dogs, there are no landscapes, nothing. They're all women. And I feel that the women in my family are what made my success possible. My mother was very wealthy, and she left China to be the wife of a very poor minister who earned $50 a month, and he gave $5 back to the church. So she had a hard adjustment. We were the family who, when we went to a restaurant, it was either a Chinese restaurant where the food was excellent and didn't cost much, or if it was American restaurant, it was $1.99 buffet. You know, take all you want, but you better finish it. You know, I had a sense that you had to value money. I could go through almost everything in this apartment and tell you what bargain I got for it. You know, these chairs came from eBay and it came with a table that was $100, you know, total. I think, it matched what my mother would say was good frugality. She never looked at anything that I bought and say, oh, you shouldn't have bought that. After I had become successful with my books, I took her to Japan and we were going to eat that first night at a Chinese restaurant.
Her finger slid across the menu from one dish over to the price. Then her finger went down, and she stopped at something that cost less, and she goes over back to the left-hand column to see what it is, and she says, soup. We can have soup. And pickles. Soup and pickles. Those are delicious. So she was frugal even to the end.
I love me some pickles. So what money lessons are you handing down? Tweet us your tips at Live Money. Many of us are going to be hitting the roads, the rails, or the skies in the upcoming weeks. It is the busiest travel season of the year, which means we need some deals. Great ones. Jason Clampett is the co-founder and head of content at Skift.com. It's a site chock full of info about travel trends and how to get the most out of your journeys. Thank you for joining us, Jason.
Thanks for having me, Carmen.
Jason, here's the thing. I feel overwhelmed, which I'm sure many folks listening do as well, with so many different ways to book travel, especially online. Should the price comparison sites be the first place folks go?
I think the first thing people should do is make a list of exactly the type of trip that they're taking, who's going with them, what they're bringing with them. And it sounds kind of simplistic, but as airlines have unbundled all their fees, what could cost you $200 round trip if you're traveling solo might cost you $375 a person round trip if you're taking luggage and gifts and checking those skis or golf clubs.
After you put your list together of who's going and what you're bringing and all of that, how do you know what airline really truly has the real best price?
Yeah, and that's the second challenge is that currently airlines don't share all of their fees with all of the outlets where you can purchase them. If you go to Expedia, you might see a fantastic deal from United or American. And then when it gets down to figuring out, okay, if I want to sit next to my child and have a guaranteed seat, oh, I need to pay an extra $50 for a seat reservation fee. So that's the next challenge is
figuring out a seat reservation fee, Jason.
Right.
Oh my God. So if I fly with my daughter, I have to pay $50 to make sure we sit next to each other.
It depends on the airline. But
wow.
We recently flew on US Airways and couldn't get a confirmed seat next to my 6-year-old, which I thought was great because it was 4.5 hours when somebody else was going to do free babysitting.
Oh my goodness.
So
right. Yeah, yeah. It depends on the person.
Yeah. So the problem is, once you find out how you're going to be traveling this time around, what I tend to do is start with a meta search site. So something like hipmunk.com or kayak.com to get a sense of what the base fares are. And that's going to tell you, you're going to see that $252 between New York and Fort Lauderdale there. The nice thing about the metasearch sites is what they do is they look at many, many other sites out there. So they will pull discounts from Priceline. They'll pull discounts from American Airlines. They'll look at Cheapo Air. They look at a broad range of sites.
Looking at travel and holiday travel as a marker of consumer confidence, where are we headed this holiday season?
Most of the airlines are saying, hey, we're going to be full. But that's been happening for the last few years. The airlines, as they hit hard times over the last decade, really the last 2 years, they've been cutting flights, unprofitable routes. There are fewer flights. There are fewer regional flights. And so planes are being flown full a lot of the time. And so when it comes to holiday times, they're going to be extra full because that's when everybody is flying. So as a sign of confidence, they're going to fill all their seats. And that's a good thing for the airlines this season.
And is there any truth to the old way of saying you got to book way early, or is it too late to book?
It'll be later tomorrow to book than it is today. So if you know where you're going, book it now.
And so for next year, though, what is the magic date that we need to shoot for? Book your holiday travel before
Well, different airlines put out their schedules at different points, and so it's typically no longer than 9 months ahead of time that you're going to find airline schedules out there. And so for holidays, waiting till early fall, because they might know more things about capacity and trends, and they might add a new route along the way, or a competitor, Southwest, might go into a city and then wait, you know, all the fares will go down. So,
wow.
You know, you can plan too far ahead.
So. Right. So about a month before the holidays.
No.
Thanksgiving.
I would have booked last month.
You would have October.
Yes. If we want to go back in time, let's do October.
So when the kids start school, the next thing you want to do is book your holiday travel.
Exactly.
Pretty much. And what about, you know, we talked about miles. Are there ways to keep these in some kind of order, make them easier to use?
You know, last year I would have given you a different answer because there are a lot of point tracker services that you could use. This year, the airline started cracking down on it. American even went so far as to say, information about your points does not belong to you. That's our basically intellectual property. We're basically just letting you use those points. And so you aren't able to, let's say, load your points into a third-party system easily.
Sites
that you could give your information to. I used to use TripitPro, which is a great app. They no longer can have American, I believe Delta and United in there because the airlines have cut off those sources of information. So keeping track of your points is just something you have to do with the airline's website in most cases.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
That's a really big deal, though, because I know that there are a lot of sites that base their business on basically managing your points and making it easier to keep track. So now the airlines want you to go to their site.
They want you to go to their site to do everything. In some respects, it's good because that's where you're going to find all the fees up front. If you're booking your ticket on Delta.com, you'll know how much you're going to pay for every step along the way. Delta may not, though, have the cheapest fare. So that's the challenge.
Well, that's when we go meta.
Exactly.
Meta sites. Thank you, Jason Clampett, so much for joining us. Jason is the co-founder and head of content at Skift.com.
Thank you.
Want more travel tips? Check out marketplacemoney.org and join the conversation about those of you who are staying put during the holidays. Why? Well, because you're working. Like Terry. She works in retail and she doesn't have Thanksgiving off. She wrote in, "I expect Black Friday in retail, but pushing it up each year is ridiculous. Will we now be open on Christmas to accept returns?" Ugh, I hope not, Terry. Tell us your working holiday story on our Marketplace Money Facebook page. You know, since the financial crisis, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been working to help regulate the scales of balance between the consumer and the lender or banker. Well, this past year, they've been focused on an especially trying issue for all too many Americans, debt collection. Here to talk about possible relief efforts is Lisa Stifler of the Center for Responsible Lending. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Now, Lisa, we know that the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act offers some protection from debt collectors. But so talk about what these new rules that the CFPB is looking to do, what are they going to add to that?
Well, at this point, it's unclear. The document that they issued last week, they call it Advance Notice for Proposed Rulemaking, is essentially a document with over 160 questions. But it appears that they seem interested in debt collection by creditors, so what they call first-party collection. They are currently not subject to the federal debt collection laws, so it only applies to third-party debt collectors collecting on behalf of others. And then in the second instance on the flow of information, the sort of advent and growth of debt buying, so there are companies, specialized companies who purchase defaulted debt from creditors, that's been a relatively new phenomenon, and no one has really taken a look at it. So some of these rules could have the potential to add a lot to what's already in place.
And, you know, the CFPB is reporting that they are getting several thousand reports because they've put out a call to ask people to tell them through their site about their own bad experiences with debt collection. Let's talk about those numbers for a second, because $5,000 doesn't seem like a lot. What are some of the numbers behind the folks that are really having trouble with debt collectors?
Well, I would also highlight that it's over 5,000 since July. Mm-hmm. It's not an insignificant number, I would say. And also note that the FTC annually receives more complaints on debt collection than any other industry. Director Cordray noted that about 30 million Americans have at least one debt in collection. And that's a significant number when you look at sort of the scale. It might be at least 1 in 10. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, there are numbers more, unclear how many, who are receiving calls or letters or a communication from debt collectors because of some questionable information or old debts. They're being pursued for debts they don't owe, debts they never owed in the first place, or for debts that have been paid or discharged in bankruptcy.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of folks unfortunately assume that folks that are in trouble in terms of debt and debt collection, I feel like they'll assume some of the worst things of people. For example, that they just went out and bought too much stuff. But there's right. a lot of other reasons why people end up in this situation, and a lot of them beyond their control, right?
Right. And I think today in 2013, a few years after the Great Recession, that's particularly so. Unemployment and underemployment are significant. You know, you lose a job and there goes your ability to pay your bills. A lot of Americans' medical problems play a huge role. And then there was just, you know, the recession came after a couple decades of an increase in the availability of consumer credit. And some of mm-hmm. that credit was on predatory terms, and others were just on terms that consumers didn't understand or were unaware of. So there are a wide range of sort of factors that come together to create a situation where they're being pursued by debt collectors.
Now, you know, when the CARD Act came about, this is the last big piece of regulation of the credit industry. You know, there was a lot of pushback from mm-hmm. the financial services and the lending sector. You know, so sometimes there is a limit to regulation. So what do you think the CFPB is going to really be able to do here? And what is the likelihood that it will be implemented?
I do believe it's inevitable there will be some rules and regulations that go into effect. They have expressed an interest and concern on a number of these topics. And likewise, I think consumer advocates and participants in sort of the debt collection world agree that there needs to be more rules and clarity on what is allowed and what is not allowed. What shape and form they take is another question. It's really unclear at this point. And a lot depends on what they hear from these comments come February when they're due.
Lisa Stifler is from the Center for Responsible Lending. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you've had a bad experience with debt collection, add your story at consumerfinance.gov and talk to us at marketplacemoney.org. We love to hear from you, whether it's over email, Facebook, or on Twitter at LiveMoney. And you can also do what this listener did. Record your question at marketplacemoney.org. It's your money, your voice.
Hi, Carmen. This is LJ from Virginia. I'm calling because I have a question about retirement. I'm in my early 30s, and I save approximately 25 to 30% of my take-home pay. And I would definitely like to retire early. What is the best way to determine when I'll be eligible to? Is there a rule of thumb based on how much I spend per year or how much I make? I'm just not sure. What are your thoughts?
Well, LJ, there is no magic number. I don't like that, but I love that you're saving so, so, so much. But saving without a goal can make you miss your mark. So here's what I want you to think about. At what age is your early retirement, and when do you want it to happen? And then when you're in retirement, what does retirement look like for you? Will you own your home outright? Will you be taking care of any children and putting them through college? Will you be taking care of aging parents? What are your expenses going to look like in retirement? And then ask this very interesting question. How old do people live to in your family? What about longevity? And how long do you think you'll need this money that you're saving up for? Crunch those numbers to get to your own personal magic number. LJ, thank you so much for your voice. What's on your mind about money? Share your thoughts, your comments, and of course, your questions at marketplacemoney.org. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we have a special collaboration with the New York Times. It's called The New Healthcare Math, all about the real cost and choices facing every income and age. Marketplace Money is produced by Dan Gretsch, Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Mary Dew, Candice Manriquez, Stan Alcorn, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon. This is APM.